And we're back, just as I warned you. By the way, before we get to our guest, I want to mention that there's going to be a book launch at a different book list. It's the author is Dr. Christopher Emden, and it's going to be Friday. I said different book list. They're one of the sponsors. The book launch is Friday, 22 April, 6 p.m. Central Tech, 725 Bathurst. You can go to Hip Hops. Get the S in there. Hip Hops Symposium. Symposium.com. But anyway, the book is great title for white folks who teach in the hood and the rest of y'all to reality pedagogy. I bet I mispronounced it. And urban education. Dr. Christopher Emden, Friday the 22nd of April, 6 p.m. Central Tech. You all know where Central Tech is. And so I'm sure you'll want to attend that. Well, joining us now is Ann Garrison. And Ann Garrison is a very prominent journalist in the Bay Area. I like to say the Bay Area. KPFA Radio, Pacifica Radio, which is, I always say, the gold standard. I say that because I kind of grew up on it. And Ann is also can be read at anngarrison.com. And welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Good to see you. And we're honored to have you here. You have been doing some outstanding journalism, particularly about matters in the Great Lakes region of Africa, articles about Rwanda, articles about Burundi. And you focused on this wonderful person, Victoire Ingabire, who is being, I would say, politically and certainly in her life, martyred by the present regime of Rwanda. She's not an armed person. She's not an advocate of violence. She's done her best to quietly represent a point of view, but it has cost her already several years in
6 years.
6 years in prison. How'd you get, by the way, start with how you knew about her? And you know, as a journalist, you've taken up this issue, and we all benefit. Everybody needs to know about her, and so we thank you for that. Who tell us about how you got involved with the issue of Victoire Ingabire.
Well, actually, it goes back to when I was doing some reporting on mining aggression in Native America. That caused me to read a lot of mining journals and mining corporation websites and so forth, and they kept leading me to the Eastern Congo, which is one of the world's greatest mineral treasure troves. And the explanation of a lot of the conflict there for the past more than 20 years. Patrice Lumumba died defending the most mineral resource province in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. But I studied that some, and then I wrote a few articles about that. Mm-hmm. And then in 2010, someone asked me if I could find out why the Green Party in Rwanda was not being allowed to stand for the election. They kept trying to register their party.
Well, there's a link I'd forgotten about. Yes. You are a Green Party person.
Yeah, I'm a member of the tiny, marginalized U.S. Green Party. Mm-hmm. And so a fellow Green asked me if I could find out why Greens weren't being allowed to stand for the election for president in 2010. I spoke to the Green candidate. And then I spoke to the other two, Bernard Ntaganda and Victoire Ingabire Mahosa. Mm-hmm. And when I spoke to Victoire, I realized that I was speaking to a really extraordinary person about an enormous lie that needed to be challenged. Mm-hmm. She challenged the dominant narrative, the narrative that has justified war in this region for the past 22 years. Mm-hmm. And it's also become a centerpiece of American war-making ideology. Mm-hmm. Every time we go to war now, almost mm-hmm. every time, if we don't say it's about terrorism, mm-hmm. it's about our moral obligation to stop genocide and mass atrocities as we failed to do in Rwanda. Uh-huh. That was brought up in Libya. It was brought up in Syria. Every time we're about to do one of these humanitarian interventions, the president of Rwanda is brought out with other characters, mm-hmm. particularly prominent Zionists, like Sheldon Adelson, Nellie Wiesel, Michael Steinhardt, when there was a lot of when there was a lot of advocacy for war in Syria after the alleged chemical weapons attack by the Assad regime, they all got together at Cooper Union to talk about how we'd failed in Rwanda and therefore we had to invade Syria.
Yes. And I, you know, by the way, you laid that out nicely, because that link that begins with there happened to be really important resources there. And so when you hear it's kind of like in the old days with the North American Indian experience, that they were in the Black Hills, which were sacred to them. And then the Americans show up and say, we did give you that, but, you know, there's some really valuable things there you don't seem to appreciate, like gold, lead, whatnot. And so we think it's best for you. You probably never become really democratic and white people unless we come into the Black Hills and kill you and take the gold. That's sort of how it worked. Could you tell, what are those minerals you're talking about in Congo?
In the Eastern Congo? I would guess that the Eastern Congo contains most every mineral resource required to manufacture modern life and modern weaponry.
Mm-hmm.
The only equivalent I know of is Afghanistan, which is hugely mineral rich. This is not much discussed, but you can find it in a book by Zbigniew Brzezinski, The Grand Chessboard,
mm-hmm.
which talks about the distribution of mineral resources around the world. These are both strategic and critical resources.
Mm-hmm.
And strategic resources are those that are needed by powers like the U.S. It's what they calculate will be needed to manufacture all the weaponry needed to fight a war and win a war with any conceivable opponent, even if the
and
supplies,
they will have it and the other guy won't have
yes.
it. Yes. Even secure
if
that.
Yes, you have to have this much in store, in reserve, mm-hmm. in case those reserves are cut off.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have enough to win any imaginable war.
Mm-hmm.
And critical mineral reserves are those required to keep manufacturing all the consumer stuff that we use.
Mm-hmm. This is Ann Garrison, and Ann is with your program is at KPFA. Pacifica is on the weekends, right? Your weekend news?
I contribute to the weekend news most every week. I also contribute to Flashpoints, Project Censored, and Women's Magazine.
And our Mr. Chalzadovsky's journal,
Global Research.
So you
yes.
can, Anne gets around. She really – and by the way, Anne, we have kind of urgent news to remind people about. This individual, Victoria Ngabire, her – conditions have been changed, perhaps as a result. I mean, this is one of those issues that we all worry about as we wage campaigns to win the freedom of people. Sometimes the people who run the prisons try to punish the prisoner. You know, more in the world, people are learning about her, and she's experiencing some difficulties. You know what is happening there?
Well, I don't know too much more than you do, but what I might speak to is that she accomplished something enormous by taking her case to the African Court of Human and People's Rights beyond the laughable Rwandan judicial system, mm-hmm. where nobody gets a fair trial. And even though Rwandan President Paul Kagame has been one of the most outspoken African leaders about the prejudiced International Criminal Court, which exists to prosecute African presidents who've fallen out of favor, basically, with the West, he withdrew from the African Court of Human and People's Rights on the day that his team was supposed to face Victoria Ngabire in court.
Yeah. Can you imagine that? I understand why he would tactically realize this is not pretty. We're going to go in the court against Victoria Ngabire, and what's going to happen?
And it's a real court with real judges. And again, he used the dominant narrative to explain it, the narrative that has dominated this region for 22 years. Mm-hmm. He says, we won't continue to participate in this court because this court is agreeing to hear the cases of genocide criminals, those who've committed genocide in Rwanda. And of course, We all know who they are, and they do not deserve due process.
Yeah. And this Victoire, just to remind our listeners, was not in Rwanda, but whatever your interpretation of the events, she was in Holland in 1994 and has never been a party to any armed movement of any sort.
No, no. She came home and said she thought the truth needed to be told, the history needed to be reconsidered, the Hutu victims needed to be remembered. Mm-hmm. And she said that before, during, and after the period known as the genocide, Hutu victims were also the victims of crimes against humanity.
Yes. And one of the net results of that is they have doubled down on the government's version of events. While, by the way, the whole wide world has been reassessing in point of fact, really prominent individuals from Mr. Kagame's own government have said, no, the picture that has been painted is not accurate. Everybody has some different notion.
And a big moment in that was the BBC documentary, Rwanda, The Untold Story.
Yes.
Which can be found on Vimeo or the YouTube.
Isn't that great, by the way? Internet is really helping. We don't have to live with one version from one book that was written 20 years ago. Every day something new can be found, and that's well established, written by people who know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
This is Ann Garrison.
I want to say about CIUT that
I'm sorry we're not fundraising. Go ahead.
No, that's not fun. I'm glad
please
we're
mention.
Not. But I want to say that it's through trying to make sense of this narrative that I found CIUT. And an African friend of mine associated with Pacifica Radio in around 2000, 2001 was at a Pacifica conference, and he was talking about his part of the world, the Congo, he said. I thought, what does he mean? He's from Uganda. And I went home and pulled down an atlas. Mm-hmm. And I started learning about what Uganda and Rwanda and Burundi have to do with Congo and the whole region. And he eventually recommended the Taylor Report.
Wow.
CIUT Taylor Report as the outlet that did the most to deconstruct this false narrative about what happened in Rwanda, which has since dominated the entire region.
I do not know this gentleman. I hope I will sometime.
Joe Wanzala.
Yeah. We have been, and you've been doing the same. Actually, the resources available to us, particularly intellectual resources, is so wide and deep, you know, from every perspective. Now there are people available to us who do deconstruct the narrative, which is really essential. I mean, I mentioned Thejin Rudasingwa, I referred to him, who served as the ambassador to the United States for Rwanda, and he has been on this show several times, and definitely he has reconstructed. We had a very dramatic moment here where he knew I was going to be interviewing the daughter of President Habyarimana, who was assassinated on April 6, 1994. And he said on air, would you mind if I stay on the broadcast? I want to hear you talk to her because I want to apologize to her, myself, mm-hmm. for what happened to her father. Because he said our president, Kagame, is the one who ordered the death, which I thought was, someone might debate him if they wish, but he's somewhat qualified.
Yeah, because the Tutsi have been allies of the West. They are favored and identified as the victims in the region. Mm-hmm. And this dominant narrative is really very racist. It's maybe a little difficult to understand in the West because this is Africa and everyone's black. But it even has a tinge of Western racism because the Tutsi are identified as regal, some racially superior, looking more Western, aquiline.
A narrative, by the way, that originated in the West. The Belgians. The Belgians were the authors of that notion.
Right.
When all they meant was these are going to be our pals, and the other guys are not going to be our pals. The former president of Tanzania, Mr. Nyerere, he was asked to solve this issue of the clash, the ethnic clash in Burundi, which we'll have to speak of in a few moments probably. He said that it's not understood in the West because this is, and they don't see it in color terms. Yet he said it is really basically the same thing as an apartheid system. Uh-huh. He was speaking at that time of a government that was entirely dominated by one ethnic group over the other one. And Nyerere was trying to be the mediator. But he said the outside world doesn't understand because, as you say, they are only seeing Africans. But they don't understand it. Of course, there are these, within Africa, very complex ethnic issues. And basically, at that time, and that was the 90s, it was an apartheid system. So we have contemporary Burundi, which is somewhat turbulent today. But that's a result of that original system, which was installed through the Belgians, who are not very helpful in all this. By the way, you were in Belgium. That's where you were given the Victoire Ingabire Prize.
Well, actually, I went the year after
by the way,
I was
can you
given.
Tell us, what's the name of that prize? I always get it wrong, and I blush all the time. But what's it called?
The Victoire Ingabire Umahosa Democracy and Peace Prize. Yeah. And as I said, the year they gave it to me in 2014, I couldn't imagine ever receiving a greater award. Although this year, I came close. In that I was number one on the alien enemies list of the Rwandan government.
You're number one.
Number one. Well, I was.
I know lawyers who are very envious of you, and journalists who can't understand how you got to be number one, and they were left out. But I suppose we could apply to them. You know, Bertolt Brecht he wrote a letter to the National Socialist Government of Germany and said, "I see you're burning books, and you haven't burned mine." So I insist that my books be burned. Otherwise, I won't be able to go to the parties, and people will be disappointed in me. This is Ann Garrison, by the way. AnnGarrison.com.
No E. A-N-N. No
yeah,
E.
She's when she does business, there's no E. We should tell people there's a new book, and we have our language issue. I wish we were broadcasting in Quebec because, of course, she has a diary now that's out. It's available, but it's only in French.
It's only in French so far, but I think that an English translation is in the works.
I guess, by the way, part of this problem she's having in prison where they took her out of a private cell, an isolated cell, and put her into what they call the population, which we all know that's always a risky business. Might have to do with a diary. They were
yes.
upset when they found out that she had a diary.
Might have to do with the diary. It might have to do with the embarrassment of the court case at the African Court of Human and People's Rights. I think that Victoire is as significant a character as Nelson Mandela, as do many other people, and a great Congolese scholar, Patrick Mbeko, who received the prize this year, said that Victoire's freedom was important for the whole region, especially his part of the world, the Congo. Rwanda has been invading the Congo since 1996, and every time it says it's going after the Hutus who committed the genocide, the Interahamwe, over and over this is recycled.
Invaded Congo twice with the same slogan.
Yes. More than twice, it sort of continued to occupy the Eastern Congo. And that we should bring up, there are four events that come up that have happened just in the past week that come under this narrative, this dominant narrative, which is that the evil, subhuman Hutus massacred the racially and morally superior Tutsi minority in Rwanda and in Burundi. That's not true. People hear a lot of.
It was not merely an ethnic clash. It was. People forget there's political parties, there are armies, and they fight under banners such as they always have nice banners. Why they're doing things. The idea of a pure ethnic clash has actually never occurred, in my knowledge.
Yeah, I know. As I said earlier, I found CIUT. And the Taylor Report, because this is the place where that false narrative has been deconstructed most. And I think one point I want to add to that that I heard brought up a number of times at this conference I came to Toronto to attend this weekend is that it's a deeply racist narrative.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you see this coming out in the war-making ideology that's based on the Rwandan genocide. You can read if you looked up – if you did a Google search for the term Hutu butchers,
mm-hmm.
you would find all kinds of references to Syria and Libya, and we had to intervene before another gang of Hutu butchers.
Yes. Well, but, yes, the idea that one portion of the population is somehow inherently extreme.
Evil, subhuman.
Or yes. Yeah. And, of course, as you say, it gets applied to other situations. So it's like an error compounded. But what we were – there are – some new developments. Incidentally, I have one I haven't yet shared with you. We drove to the station and I didn't tell you, but I just had a report from Zambia, and I know many of our listeners are from the Great Lakes region and try to keep up with the news. There have been riots in Lusaka today, which were directed at Hutu refugees. Where the accusation is that they are thieves or that costing resources and also a source of violence. Pretty much what you read when you hear about Syrian refugees in Europe or refugees from Africa and the Middle East in Europe, where they say, well, somebody has raped someone or someone has been murdered and they think it might have been one. And it seems to be just it has a kind of – it's like catnip. Once you've said it, whether it's true or not, people bring out all their animosities or all the stereotypes they've been fed. But just for our listeners to know that in Zambia, there have been riots today directed at those refugees. And those Rwandans who are living there as refugees – have been under pressure from the Paul Kagame's government in Rwanda to return to Rwanda. And the government of Zambia has been pressed by Paul Kagame to make those refugees go back, and they have resisted. Actually, the new government of Zambia has been one that has said that isn't a question we're going to go into because they are legitimate refugees and that's the end of the subject. But one way to make the subject come back is to have suddenly people in the streets yelling and pointing or setting fire to somebody's house and saying, oh, he's a murderer. And then you can create an anxiety in the public. So many are suspicious as to where is the origin of this. And we have another news story from Burundi, which only came yesterday.
There were four ruling party members killed in Burundi. They were engaged in an environmental cleanup exercise when they were killed by masked men with assault rifles. And the curious thing about this and the repetition of the dominant narrative is mm-hmm. that the wire services reported this. There were four ruling party members killed by masked men, et cetera, in this environmental cleanup exercise. And it's the fault of the president. It's the fault of the ruling party whose members were assassinated. Mm-hmm. Because
but much the way they spoke about Bagbo in Ivory Coast and Habyarimana in Rwanda, and now we're in Burundi in the same. They're putting the pressure, the blame on the fact that his party put him forward as a presidential candidate for what they said was his second term. And it was debated by his enemies, and they took it to the Supreme Court, which in most countries is where the subject is supposed to end. Supreme Court said President Nkurunziza's party is correct, and the election will go forward. And Washington and London and Paris said that's not correct. The Supreme Court of Burundi is not equal to us, colonial powers, so anything happens from now on is because of him, because of his decision to run for election, which, by the way, an election he won. He's a highly popular individual. They always leave that out. Nkurunziza is actually popular.
Hugely popular with the rural majority, and Burundi is majority rural subsistence farming people.
But it is a shock. What you just described, here are four government officials ordinarily going about their business, never dreaming that somebody with a high-powered rifle and a mask is going to begin to open fire. And, of course, it goes back, well, so who is that? And the government of Burundi is pretty sure it has something to do with the government of Rwanda, which and I guess this is an important detail. You must have noticed.
Yes, it's been documented that in Rwanda, in refugee camps in Rwanda, Rwandan military are recruiting or forcibly conscripting Burundian refugees and training them to form a new rebel army to go into Congo and penetrate Burundi across the eastern Congolese border. And the same dominant narrative about Hutus threatening Tutsis is being used over and over again here. Yeah. And there's also Leon Mugesera. There was a conviction this week. There was a life sentence to a someone who spent time in Canada who was deported.
That was a highly disputed matter. We spoke to the lawyer in that case. But by the way, the timing is all – it's like watching a storm develop, and now we're seeing lightning. All these things, incidentally, can I would say to our listeners, I'll bet you agree with this, this is something – you have to work at if you want to comprehend it, because if you just go by the brand and the names, you will end up with alphabet soup and a bunch of simplistic nonsense. But all of these things actually deserve serious concentration and attention. I'd love to talk about and I do intend in the near future to bring in Mr. La Rochelle, an outstanding Canadian lawyer who handled the Mugesera case, who, you know, to walk us through the complexity of that. And I'd love to try it today, but believe me, I'm not going to be able to do it. But all these things are fit into a pattern, most of it coming down on the heads of the government, the people of in Bujumbura. I'd say the hot spot at the moment is definitely Burundi, where the U.S. is insisting on a new, just as with Syria, a new regime, a new government.
Burundi is the tiny East African nation of Burundi is sub-Saharan Africa's Syria right now.
Yeah.
And we were going to, you know what, we were going to talk about Bernie and the American election and everything.
I was going to ask you.
But we ran out of time, so the only thing I'm going to say is that I'm a member of the Green Party, and a lot of Greens are supporting both our Green candidate, Jill Stein, and Bernie Sanders.
Wow, Anne Garrison got it all done in the 30 minutes, and we appreciate her coming today. I want to thank Hanny and Charlotte, who also saw to it that the boat didn't sink. So we'll see you next week.
Thank you.